Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
Excuse me, everyone. Class is about to begin.
No, do with authority like you mean it.
Seth, stop talking.
We had an interesting set of blogs.
Nicely done.
Nice set of blog entries, fellas. One of the assertions that were made around Grand Theft Auto, one of the themes is, why don't we have sex in our games? Two assertions I heard, there were themes. One is, I think Chris, you made this one, people aren't going to buy it if they're rated wrong. So if the ratings go to adult only, people aren't going to buy it. There's not going to be revenue generated from the games. Two, I think Ted, Naughty 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 was the name of yours. It's just wrong. The other assertion was about youth in the games, that there's too many kids running around. You shouldn't have sex in the games because it's a deleterious influence on the young mind. I wanted to draw your attention on the board here to a project, a guy out at Stanford named Nick Yee. He's just finished his PhD in psychology from Stanford, and he worked with the VR labs there. Nick did a study in a project called the Daedalus Project. Forgive my recollection, it's either 30 or 40,000 people were interviewed in the course of the projects. Here's the age distribution of MMORPGs at the time the study occurred. So what conclusions would you draw from that based upon the ages that are at risk for being subjected to sexual imagery in these games?
They can all legally look at porn, or at least 60% can.
Well, I'm seeing 18 and above. What do we got there, Matt?
Some uber numbers. More than
80% or
60. Yeah, a lot. 79.9% of people don't care.
You got to think about, just because they're old enough to look at it doesn't mean they want to. Second Life. I liked playing it until I found out it was like a platform for porn, and I left the game because I found out how pervasive it is in that game. Because that's what happens; it just takes over.
But one of the assertions that were made, the reason why I want to continue that discussion, but one of the assertions that were made thematically through your blog entries was that this is a youth-dominated experience. The data here doesn't suggest that. Chris, go ahead.
If you lose a fourth of your subscribers, that's still a big number. Not that it's dominant, but you can't just drop a fourth of your subscribers and not blink an eye. If it's World of Warcraft, you have 8 million people, that's 2 million people gone.
Significant impact, isn't it?
It's also... Sorry.
Jump in there, guys.
I was going to say, you also probably wouldn't gain many subscribers by adding it, because that was one of the ones I...
Did you have something, Jeff?
No, I actually said that in my blog entry.
Matt? And then Ted,
you go first. The ECSA fact that I quoted in my blog, it said that the average game player is 33 years old, and it's something like 65% are older than 25 or something like that.
Well, so the thing about being too young. If we go with these statistics from Daedalus and some of these statistics that Ted cited, it's really only 20%. Now, Chris is saying, hey, 20% of 8 million, that's a lot of cash. Matt, go ahead with it.
Last year I did this research, and it's called the NAG factor. And the younger kids are the more fickle market, where if they nag their parents enough, they will buy that game. So that's kind of what makes or breaks you, is that 20% right there. Because between 18 and 35, they're intelligent consumers, where they're not just going to buy a crappy game if they know it's bad, but a kid may buy a really bad game if he hears that it's cool, and then he can nag his parents enough to buy it. What do you think?
I think there's a lot of truth. There's a lot of truth to that. I know I got two youngins, and they will nag me about various Mario editions that are coming out of Nintendo, and they want it.
Galaxy?
Yeah.
It's gotten some pretty good hype.
It's about 9.8.
So, guys, one thing also on these demographics, what is interesting about the 23 to 28-year-old range that you see that may be a wee bit different?
Male-to-female ratio.
Is that the one time that the male-to-female ratio gets inversed from the previous trends and the trends after that?
Not even close. So
old life.
Old ladies in the age group of age 23 to 28?
No, that's just, 23
that's just
to
percentage
over 35.
Of old
yeah. Percentage of old ladies.
That's not, that's not an absolute number. There's still more men playing.
There were only total 78.
It's just in that age group, right?
Yeah. So the normal person gets married between the ages just like 23
females.
So
Tulsa's
you don't get married. Play MMOs, I guess.
Also saw a reference to a night elf dance in World of Warcraft that people said that these, there are some suggestive things in games today.
The night elf dance is based on a European singer. It's not. I mean, it's not. It's not. You know,
so,
supposed to be sexual. It's supposed to be like pot. It's based on pot. Just like the blood elf dance. Male is based on pulling dynamite. It's just something.
Does that mean that
is somewhat sexual?
Yeah. Does that mean that all stars?
It's actually
not
lame.
Sexual.
It's like this. Just woman. Like she's just like doing this. It doesn't even make sense.
I don't know.
I didn't think it was really.
Well, there was a reference. Did you make the night elf reference?
Yeah.
Help us out there. Tell us what your thoughts are.
I mean, it's still sexual. I mean, if you just look at the movement of her. She just looks sexual. I mean, whether it's from a pop star or not, I mean, it's still a sexual reference.
I mean, some of those night elves are hot to start out with. You can make a pretty hot World of Warcraft.
Well, my whole deal was cartoons aren't hot.
The gear.
I think
and the gear,
the
woman
gear
is like Skippy as crack, too.
Hey, one thing I also want to draw. Go ahead, Seth. And then
well, when I made Candy for Lotro, you could control her bust size.
Oh, look at him smiling.
My entire home was in my room making my character. We were just messing around with
it. Between references in your blog, Matt, and then his controlling Candy.
I thought it was.
Well, Matt made a good reference in his blog, and then he said, what if your parents walked in and saw you playing a game as a 13-year-old playing a sexually oriented game? How do you think your parents are going to react to that?
That's nice,
man. That's what all Tab is for, actually.
Yeah. Have a look up here on Age of Conan's new MMORPG title. This is from MMORPG, the blog. Go ahead and someone read some of that out there for me.
Aside from a plethora of character clashes, a rich world, action-packed combat, and all other elements that make a good MMORPG, Age of Conan, PC and Xbox 360, offers more to step up the activities that you can do. Word from Games Convention 2007 in Leipzig revealed that this hot online game from Funcom and Eidos Interactive will allow players to fornicate and reward them for it. It hasn't been confirmed what benefits will be given to those that hit it off with their avatars, but it's definitely going to be a positive buff. Stronger knees and higher charisma sound quite feasible. Age of Conan will remain rated M by the ESRB, which could only mean that we won't really see anything explicit. According to the report from MMORPG.com, that seems to be the case. Remember what hot coffee did? None of that is in this game.
Wow, hot coffee.
So, sex in a narrative confers a gameplay mechanical benefit. You fornicate, you get buffed.
Isn't that like in Grand Theft Auto, though? That's hot coffee.
No.
Like,
you lose money.
If you took a...
Like prostitute.
The prostitutes, and they would heal you.
Yeah.
Then you could kill them and get your money back.
Well, man.
Your blog entry dealt with some of this. I mean, the screenshot that Daniel put in his was, one a big booty scene from Grand Theft Auto. Right? You want to talk to your blog entry?
Well, like, yeah, I don't think Grand Theft Auto is not, it's not an online narrative game, though. I said, in an online narrative game, you're more like acting. Like I feel like that I was more like acting like I would act myself. Like my character was me. I was playing around, but like in like Grand Theft Auto, I was pretending like I was someone else, like someone who would do that to a prostitute. So
playing a character that was established
right,
in the game.
Right.
So a number of you interpreted the blog topic a little differently from the way I thought you would. I thought that the blog topic would be asking about why the narrative line inside a game would not contain romantic stories with sexual content the way Spencer does, as opposed to the game's permitting you to engage in sex with your avatar, I wondered why the narrative arcs were so always about violence and never about love, and including love with an erotic dimension to it. It seems to me very interesting that the Western canon of literature that you're taught from high school onward, from Homer through Virgil, Dante, certainly into our readings from Spencer, and on beyond Spencer to poets like Keats, Tennyson later in the 19th century, are full of a fascination for all forms of love, love from ideal love, being a kind of agape, that is a sign of the highest aspirations of the human spirit toward God, which would be one definition of agape, to eros, which is, sexual love, to hermaphroditic love that you certainly see in Plato and in Spencer, all kinds of The Four Loves is a book by C.S. Lewis, which talks about different kinds of love. Keratos, that's a good one.
It's the eros, that's right. The erotic love.
So the question is, our culture, even the culture we most revere, is quite frank about sexuality and is less involved in violence. I mean, though there's certainly a lot of violent episodes in this book as well. But why do we design these stories in our video games that are focused, almost 100% on violence and completely devoid of any kind of amorous? I'm trying to think of a broad enough word, so let us say amorous narrative content that would include just even nice, gentle romance, falling in with some of our characters in the narrative arc, falling in love, and you having to have a quest to help them achieve their, separated lovers, Romeo and Juliet kind of things, Tristan and Isolde scenarios. Why are all of those missing from the narratives that our games provide? I think your hand was up first.
Well, I mean, violence is such an easier, much easier emotion to convey in a game, whereas with love, it would be pretty much an empty gesture if it was just like, you saw this person love, you were supposed to love. But with violence, it's much easier to be like, well, here's this thing, I have to go kill it, rather than love this person. There's more of a, you almost think more when you're supposed to love. Why should I love? What do they do? Why are they great? There's a violence, you can just kill it.
That is a tough comment. There's no love in there because you have to think when love's involved. Go ahead.
I mean, because I feel like when you make a new character now and you're like, okay, I have to deliver the pies again, or I have to go kill these barrel whites again. I feel like if you had to fall in love with the same person again, it would feel kind of cheesy, because there's always more barrel whites to kill, so it seems almost continuous. But if it's just like, oh, here's Susie again, I guess I have to deliver flowers to her again, then I have to make her a pie, because if it was just involving love, the violence in here involves action, so the love would also have to involve action and a plot, so instead of, you can't really do the emotions, so you'd have to do actions such as, delivering flowers, or if they wanted to be really into it, they could add a sex to the thing, but I think that's sort of out of it. But
also, a lot of gamers are guys, and if you ask guys like what kind of movie or what kind of game they want to play, it's not a romantic comedy, it's more of an action, or a majority of guys,
unless you're mad,
because if you're going to bring up that statistic, it says from your database, it said that there were 5,000 guys and 700 girls
in the sample.
So what is this?
Big sample.
You're pointing our attention to the
The reason why Matt gave us a trigger on the gender differences in Desire Games. This is an article, Gaming Gets a Female Touch. Go ahead, and this is I've seen this many times, but you may just want to read the abstract and go to ProQuest and check it out. Talks about the types of games females versus males tend to purchase, and this is demographic marketing data.
I see.
And it's things like Nintendogs, The Sims,
I see.
And healers in MMORPGs.
Yeah, and in love, like with love, you can't really love in a game, but you can love in real life. And we can all love in real life. We can all have like a girlfriend or a boyfriend. But like in the game, I mean, you can slice and dice a boar, but you can't do that like outside. So that's what it gets at.
I mean, you're not slicing and dicing a boar. You're doing pressing keys.
It's simulated action.
Yeah, I mean, you could.
Oh, you're slicing.
you can do that in real life. I've done that.
Yeah.
With an axe?
I've done
as
that.
As a troll?
No, not with an axe. No, you can stab boars in real life.
He's
right.
This is a great transition. I'm glad we're talking about boars, since the Venus and Adonis story is all about boars. So thank you for that transition. You had another comment to make.
Oh, I was going to say, like, when you're falling, like, when you're, like, doing an action scene in a game, I'm all about, like, imagining myself as someone point that out. Like, I can imagine myself, like, you know, like, attacking this thing, like, whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it looks like. It's really hard for me to, like, imagine myself falling in love with, like, a computer-generated avatar, because I can tell it's computer-generated. Like, I know it's not real. Like mm-hmm. if it looked more realistic, like, I think, like, as like, technology gets better and better, like more realistic the avatars look, then I think you could be able to fall in love with like a character like that.
Like in the plot of numerous movies about virtual reality where people fall
right.
in love with, they're kind of, it's really the Pygmalion story,
right.
isn't it? Or the right. Galatea story where your own imaginative creation comes to life and then you fall in love with it. So you could imagine that.
Like, I couldn't fall in love with the stick figure. I mean, I think you can relate to, like, you can't fall in love with the stick figure even if it talked. Like, but, like,
I mean, I don't fall in love with every character I read about in a love plot.
Right.
But I do find myself fascinated by stories like Tristan and Isolde or Romeo and Juliet or other, you know, just name your great love plot that you can read. So there's some kind of middle ground here that we haven't quite discussed yet, but I do appreciate the truth of your point about the stick characters. Yes.
Well, I think one of the key points with MMORPGs is that it's a social experience, and that's one of the key draws to the game, is that you're doing stuff with friends, and that's why I play MMORPGs instead of regular RPGs, because I'm not looking for such a rich storyline. I'm looking for having fun with my friends, and it's hard to fall in love with someone in a group. You're both trying to fall in love with
SWG allowed in-game marriages, and there were lots of really nice big ones. Big events and ceremonies.
I was just thinking about that middle ground. Well, the way I see it, you can't really force a player, because in video games as a medium, like when you're a player, you're acting yourself, you're taking the role of the person you're controlling. So you can't force them into a relationship they don't want to get into. But what you could do, maybe, is like have them rescue a damsel who wants to get back to her prince. Like, you could incorporate the mm-hmm. love and the potentially sex, like, insinuations or something like that in that way.
I think you could, yeah. That is exactly the kind of middle ground that I'm talking about. Max?
Up until now, we've only talked about, like, gamers falling in love or being attracted to, like, somebody in the game, but are we also talking about, like, in-game characters falling in love with each other and stuff
yes.
like that? Because I feel like it's more realistic. I mean, clearly we're not going to fall in love with somebody in the game, or most people don't. But, I mean, you can still appreciate love or a relationship in a game between two characters, which, actually, there's a series of quests in Lotro, in the Shire, or no, not in the Shire, in Staddle, where you have to sort of get two farm, like a widow farmer, I can't remember.
Right,
name,
right.
Together with another guy.
That's right. And that's a great example, and that's sort of what you were talking about too, and that is a bit of the middle ground. Lotro plays it for comedy, which is not a bad choice. You know, they're kind of elderly, dumpy looking hobbits, and you know, you're not sitting there You know, imagine you're, we've been talking about this demographic of 13-year-old boys. Well, imagine, you know, just to play to stereotypes, you're a 13-year-old girl who might think it was really romantic to see, you know, Lancelot and Guinevere or, you know, whatever story you want. But clearly one solution to that that Lotro has at least played with is romance as comedy. Not thigh-slapping comedy, but, you know, mildly amusing. Did I see your hand up, Seth?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know why there isn't more of it in there, though, because I've seen a lot of that in one-player games, like Baldur's Gate.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of little side quests where, I remember one, some person was slipped a love potion, and you had to go around and be the middleman saying, you know, gave him the love potion, so he accidentally fell in love with her. You had to, like, figure out the whole web of this one person who wanted her crush to fall in love with her, and it all went wrong. And so you kind of had to figure out what happened. And I mean, there are a lot of those too. I don't understand why there isn't one where maybe you have to, you know, talk between Aragorn and Arwen or something like that.
Cool.
But
right.
I did play one game once where there was a big, like a large part of the game was love. It was Harvest Moon, the Nintendo 64.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And a big part of that game was like getting married and having a kid. And you had like five people to choose from, and you know, who you wanted to marry.
Interesting.
And you had to, you know, bring them gifts and talk to them and find them on special days.
That's a mechanism. It's a game I didn't know about. So in a way, the question was an error. I mean, the topic could have been disputed. That yes, there are these examples. That's
but it's so rare.
It is rare.
I was going on Wes's point about how single player games have more of a connection, like in Final Fantasy. Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, yes. I have that up on my Wikipedia.
Like it was the story was amazing. Like, and I think you play single player games for that.
The story was amazing.
Yes,
that's what you want. That's what I'm looking for in online games. Is stories that bring out comments like the story was amazing, so that you get both the social world, the virtual reality, the being able to be in a virtual reality situation with your friends, and also be able to say, and the story was amazing.
BioWare MMO.
You think it's there?
Oh, I think they're like the best storytellers as game developers. Like,
for sure.
Who is it?
BioWare.
They're like Baldur's Gate and Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
But those are still single.
But they're making an MMO.
Which one?
KOTOR.
It's
indeterminate at this point.
Do you like single player games like where you go through like a story and like Call of Duty?
I'm more interested in this.
Okay.
I mean, of course, I like them.
Do you think that the story? I mean,
Half-Life has a good story
to it.
Halo. Like the Resistance,
mm-hmm.
I think it has a great storyline to it.
Okay, we need to move on from that to Spencer, and I wanted us to talk some more about this. I'm having computer difficulties here. I wanted to talk some more about Spencer. We didn't get very far. In our consideration of Canto, Book 3, Canto 1, but we did establish some of the terms for reading this work. Today I wanted to talk with you about I wanted to start with a discussion of Britomart's experiences at Castle Joyous. Really, Britomart's experiences on the plane before Castle Joyous and then inside Castle Joyous, and then compare it with what is probably the most famous single canto in all six books of the Faery Queen, which is Canto 6, The Garden of Adonis. And it may be the most famous, but in some ways, many undergraduates find it the least fun of the cantos. I'll be curious to hear how you all responded to it. And for class on Thursday, your role is to finish book three, as you know. And I think that we'll probably need to have a thoroughgoing quiz on the reading that will be as craftily designed as I can possibly design it to be utterly easy if you've read the book and utterly impossible if you've only read the Cliff Notes or the Spark Notes or any of the other notes. So that is, you know, just instead of it being a pop quiz, this is going to be an announced quiz, because I think it's only fair for those of you that are engaged with this, with the Spencer and reading it, to get credit for your work. So let's go back to the Britomart in Canto 1, and let's Professor Hall, let's will you keep a good eye on the clock over there? Sure. And give us at least 10 to 15 minutes to talk about Neverwinter Nights. Okay. So, outside Castle Joyous, what happens? Tell us the story loudly, boldly, with gusto.
Comes upon fair maiden, Britomart, comes upon the six knights fighting off the, or the one guy fighting off the six knights,
yes.
Because he would not profess his, or say that his love was
less fair
than the queen, or the, not the queen, the lady inside, whatever.
The chick in the castle. What was her name?
Lusty lady.
Malacastle.
So anyway, Britomart comes up and asks what's going on, kind of breaks up the fight for a minute, says what's going on. They tell the story, and he said he wouldn't say that the queen was, or that his love was not as true or whatever. So she helps him fight off the guys. She defeats four of them, and so they go into the castle.
Sure, that's terrific. Who did it turn out to be? The knight. The Red Cross Knight. Red Cross hero of book one, who is loyal to his fair love, Una, heroine of book one. So here, popping back up in book three is our Red Cross Knight. So Britomart's pretty tough. She takes these guys and teaches them a lesson.
Pretty bad.
And then they go into Castle Joyous. Now, one thing I'd like you all to pay attention to as you read is the way landscapes and architecture functions as symbolic space and psychological space. In Spencer, you know, you've found a lot of spaces. Name some of the spaces, both natural world and architectural world, that you've encountered in any of the six books, and talk about them. Yeah, so
you have Merlin's Cave.
Merlin's Cave, very interesting. What did that remind you of?
Somewhat of in Beowulf the Cave.
Oh, in Beowulf the Cave, yeah, it's right.
You're going down to
anything that we've encountered more recently in our lives?
Plato's the Cave.
Plato's the Cave is certainly invoked, as are the shadows. Yet not in necessarily in the Merlin passage, but elsewhere in this passage. It's interesting that all, you know, in 2006 you had Mackenzie Wark talking about introducing his book on online games via Plato's Cave, and back in the 16th century you have Spencer introducing many aspects of his imaginative world via Plato's Cave. It's really quite a persistent image for the relationship between the imagination and reality, for the relationship between hopes and ideals and the everyday experience. Other spaces. The Merlin's Cave, you haven't told me what else it reminds you of. Can you turn rapidly to it or not? Who can turn rapidly to it?
Man, so lucky.
Maybe it would be in book 3, Canto 3, Stanza 12.
18.
I'm there.
Star 18, yeah. Well, turn rapidly to that space.
18 or
12. Well, let's enjoy them both.
I'm at like page 18 out of 43 in the little
pile
there.
Okay, book 3, Canto 3,
Stanza 12.
Stanza 12 is where it starts. For he by words could call out of the sky both sun and moon and make them him obey, the land to sea and sea to mainly dry and darksome night he could turn to day. And then there's the Lady of the Lake in this passage. And I want us on 12. Stick with 12. Huge hosts of men he could alone dismay, and hosts of men a meanest thing could frame, when so him list his enemies defray, that to this day for terror of his fame the fiends do quake when any him to them does name. And he goes on. What's going on? What's his cave like? Merlin's cave's like, just geographically. What's going on in it?
He's writing.
There's a wall being built. Built. What else? What?
The wall was being built in the cave. I thought it was outside.
The wall was going to be put up outside the cave.
Those compass.
Okay. Look at
it's
9.
Scary.
Yeah, it's scary. Look at stanza 9. But standing high aloft, low lay thine ear, and there such ghastly noise of iron chains and brazen cauldrons thou shalt rumbling hear, which thousand sprites with long enduring pains do toss, that it will stone thy feeble brains, and oftentimes great groans and grievous stounds, when too huge toil and labor them constrains, and oftentimes loud strokes and ringing sounds from under that deep rock most horribly abounds. Yes.
Are you trying to invoke Cave of Moria?
Well, yes, possibly Moria. I was even thinking of a different cave.
Oh, under the
Saruman's cave. Saruman's cave with him, the magician, with all those orcs down there building, you know. And,
yeah.
Remember that from the movie? I mean, of course. Moira.
I thought that was kind of what we did.
It was kind of a pit.
Yes.
This kind of a pit.
Some say tomato, some say
tomato. Yeah.
I have a question. I don't know if anyone else has this problem, but when I read that stanza, it means very. I couldn't get from that stanza what you all clearly just did.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's a thank you, Tim, for that.
I can't. I read it. I go. What?
Thank you for that helpful comment. Are other people having trouble just understanding that stanza?
Every
stanza you encounter. You
I mean, I started making like the little notes, and I think I'm getting like the big picture.
Excellent.
I think it's hard too because they say like he and she all the time, and I don't know who they're referring to.
Yeah. I get lost with
it. Yeah, they say someone's name, and then they go off on a tangent.
Right.
Like that person.
And then it's back to he or she, and I'm like, okay, who's it?
Yeah, between not being like the English language I'm used to, and then also having it be in like somewhat of a poetic form, so that sometimes they say he or she just because the name doesn't necessarily fit with the poem, I just
bingo. And furthermore, oftentimes these characters have multiple names or referred to by their characteristics rather than by their proper name. Well, it makes it quite complex. It's hard going. Hard is the way that you have to take to get this out. Wesley made a point that I hope many of you share, which is that when I read it out loud, it sounded clearer. You need to do that. You need to read poetry out loud to yourself. Maybe not every single stanza, but often. If any passage doesn't seem as clear to you, you can't read poetry like you read prose. It's got its own conventions. It's got its own difficulties, and it's not quite like reading a foreign language, but it is a kind of talent or skill that you have to develop. You have to move up from being a level 10 poetry reader, which is what you probably were when you graduated from high school. If you could get into Vanderbilt, you know, you were no doubt at least level 10. You probably leveled all the way to 12, grade appropriate poetry reading. But, you know, you need to move on and get up into the 30s by the end of your freshman semester, wouldn't you say? What?
Is there a limit to how many levels we can go up?
50.
Okay.
By now, 50. They may expand it.
Okay.
As poetry becomes more popular in the 21st century, we're gonna see that level. We're going to get that expansion pack on poetry coming.
To the Robert Frost.
What's your level?
I don't know. That would be, you know,
way up there. He's a dev. He's
Tim, that's a really, really great point, and it's perhaps something we should have emphasized more completely last week. We were having an excellent discussion. I didn't want to break the momentum. But, you know, there's just no way around practice. You know, you just have to learn to read poetry. You have to put your eyes on the page. You have to slow down. You have to, each time you get one of those she's that you can't track back, you have to work it on, you work on back, and you got to look at other kinds of clues, like what the attributes are of the character, and work your way through it, and try reading it out loud. So there in stanza 9, did you get now from stanza 9?
Yeah, a little bit better. I mean, it's still like, I have trouble with poetry, so I get.
No, that's not, actually, you start out really well. But we can't rest with this comment. I have trouble with poetry.
I know what I have to do now. It's just like, it's still, even hearing it out loud, I need to hear it probably more than once.
Right. Now, you know, why do you need to learn to read poetry?
You don't. It helps you think
that's an answer.
Way. It helps you think a different way.
It does help you think a different way.
It's a way of learning to learn a different way.
Both of those comments are very astute versions of the same thing. It is a kind of discipline that helps you develop a certain kind of mental acuity that you wouldn't have had otherwise. Why, any other reasons you might need to learn? I mean, I've still heard Chris's assertion that you don't need to.
Do you want to be an English professor?
Let me tell you, it's a very tough row to hoe to become an English professor, and I wouldn't, if that were the only reason to learn to read poetry, I wouldn't be spending any time trying to teach you it. I would let that be a self-selecting group. Other reasons?
Is your reading comprehension?
It does. Reading comprehension.
In case you want to write poetry.
And in fact, that's one of the largest motives for English majors. We have a big creative writing contingent. People who want to write poetry or fiction have to learn to be good readers of poetry. You know, the saddest spectacle is the person who wants to be a poet but doesn't want to read any poetry. And guess what? That kind of person does not succeed. Yes.
I feel like poetry oftentimes comes from within yourself. And if you can learn to understand other people's poetry, then you can learn to understand your own sort of poetry.
Thank you for that comment. Yes, a kind of a self-discovery. You know, many genres of writing offer self-discovery. Novels certainly do. Some movies do. Nonfiction can. Autobiography certainly are routes to self-discovery. Poetry is its own kind, and it is often associated with interiority. Poetry is often thought of as the genre, the kind of writing in this life that is most deeply connected with inner aspirations, inner feelings, deeper thoughts about the meaning of life and of existence. And so that's a reason to develop this skill further.
He's trying to get, all poets are trying to get some sort of point or story across, and you'll understand it and maybe broaden your looks at it. And also, if you know poetry like Spencer's, because a lot of people know Shakespeare, but I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that I think are well-read and things, and they don't really know who Spencer is or what the Fairy Queen's about, even if they do know who Spencer is.
And so, you know, if you're on a first date or something and you think they'll be wowed by your knowledge of reading, you can explain to them Spencer and what his fairy queen means. And
I can tell you, just learn, write a poem, give it to a girl.
Chick's dick poetry.
Works every time.
Even if you don't know her.
Cycle the names.
Especially tape it on her door.
She won't fans creep.
They'll swim.
Love advice from
they'll swim.
Post it on the wall.
How to be a stalker 101. Let's reboot that conversation.
Yes. Good. Move on along. But there is a kind of, I mean, the crudest way to rephrase your, not the crudest way, a negative way to rephrase what you've said is a kind of a cultural display, a kind of one-upmanship. But there's a positive way to phrase that, and I was surprised that nobody went that direction, which is that part of becoming an educated member of our society being is having a certain cultural competence, an ability to understand the references that do circulate in intellectual journalism and the world of debate, the world of conversation. And poetry is a great source for that. And that's what we're really going to be talking about right now as we talk about Castle Joyous and Garden of Adonis. We're going to be talking about some mythic references that structure these two scenes that, you know, sort of everybody ought to know about to be a really well-educated person.
So one thing I'd offer into this conversation, I need you to pick it up here because this is really not my cup of tea. Iambic pentameter, rhyme and meter are very important. I think for us to actually enjoy it and understand it, how many people know what I am, not know what, have heard of it, but know what iambic pentameter is? We're saying everybody knows what it is.
Essentially, almost all. Okay.
I see a lot of hesitancy when the hands went up, too. Well, I'm going to put it up there. This isn't great enthusiasm that you would go in the same way that you guys were talking about Dallas Cowboys and the football teams on ESPN. I didn't see that level of enthusiasm around I am. Well, I mean, but maybe there's a reason why.
No.
Professor Clayton, I think understanding the mechanics of IM, is it appropriate with Spencer in this context to understand the mechanics? That'll offer further enjoyment as to how you read this out loud.
That's absolutely right. Iambic pentameter is the basic. Iambic pentameter is the basic prose rhythm of the English language. It is the least sing-songy of any poetic line. If you think of really sing-songy verse, it's generally in iambic tetrameter, which is four beats, or trimeter, which is three beats. So, and often the most sing-songy poetry you've ever heard in your life is alternating iambic tetrameter with iambic trimeter, so that the poem goes da 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 da. Whereas iambic pentameter, by adding that fifth foot, makes it closer to the rhythms of prose, and you will find that often in a great speech that you read somewhere, or that you listen to in the political season that's coming up, or that's always already upon us, you'll find passages that just fall into iambic pentameter, and they're often the most mesmeric and powerful passages in the whole speech. So that, again, a kind of understanding of the rhythmic characteristics of prose is not a bad skill to have, both as a writer and as a listener, because you hear it more than you see it in today's society. So as we started to say last class period, the Spencerian stanza, which he made his own, is nine lines long. The first four lines are very traditional ABAB rhyme scheme. But then he varies it a little, and he repeats the B He goes B, C, B, C, so that the second four lines, which we would call a quatrain, the second quatrain, if it were a separate stanza, we'd call it a quatrain, but the second quatrain within the Spenserian stanza is again B, C, B, C. So that's a very traditional A, B, A, B, but usually it would be C, D, C, D. Correct, that's right. Instead, what effect does it have to prolong BB, to pick that B up there, sustain it right there, and bring it on through to there? What effect do you think it has in the poetic? Yeah, tell.
Continuity.
Yeah, a lot of continuity, yes.
I was going to say it connects the two quatrains together into flows.
Exactly, so the flow is much enhanced. It turns out that's really effective for a narrative poem to keep these, you know, these stanzas could really chop up the narrative and fragment it and make it much, you know, you'd be felt like you're being picked to death by birds or something with a little stanza, little with other verse forms. Here, it sustains that flow rhythmically, musically. Then what about the C in there? The C comes in like this, you know, makes its appearance late in the stanza, and then suddenly is dominant. I'm trying to use sort of musical language here. What effect does that have?
It emphasizes the last.
It certainly does. And what does emphasize in your last line do? Just something I talked about when we were writing our class.
It drives the point home.
It gives a sense of closure. So you get in these Spenserian stanzas a tension between fluidity and flow and closure, so that each of the stanzas has both an ongoing narrative movement and a door closing feel. And it's called, and the last line also varies in a different way. It's an Alexandrine, which is a very unusual verse form in English, even though it is dominant in French poetry of this period, which is iambic hexameter, six beats long, not five. So Spenser has a kind of double closure to each stanza. Did you have your hand up, Max? Okay, this is many long digressions.
Is the first line also six?
No, it is not. No, it is not. I don't know why they space it like that.
Long digressions of great utility to be better consumers. Yeah.
Better consumers, that's great. I'm sorry, my computer keeps glitching. So after Britomart owns those six rival knights, she gets conducted into Castle Joyous. I'm sorry it was hard going in the reading, but let's see if we can reconstruct what happens when we go into Castle Joyous. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What?
Slapping.
Why?
Pages of description and pages.
Pages.
Well,
of mesmerizing.
Oh, mesmerizing, of course. Description.
Description.
That's really.
What?
Thrilling.
Thrilling. You found it not to your taste.
No action.
A little bit long-winded there. Description. Gives Dickens a run for his money.
A little bit.
So let us go back to Castle Joyous. And we've had some kind of qualitative remarks. Let's get some... not quantitative so much. We've had evaluative remarks. Let's have some kind of summary of what you actually see when you go inside it. What kind of spaces are they? Castle-like spaces. Feasting.
Lavish.
Lavish feasting spaces. Are you going to be able to create that castle?
Sure.
Tim, you had your hand up?
I was going to kind of say that I thought it was funny that in the book on chastity there's a lot of castle, I
think this is it's a really important remark.
Yeah, I think that was
here's a really important remark in a book about chastity. The first interior space you go into is Castle Joyous, it's called, and it's not mincing any words about what constitutes joy in this castle. Well, you've already mentioned feasting. What else?
Sex.
Sex. Drink. What else? Food and drink. What are the kind of central pleasures are on display in Castle Joyous? Maybe I've exhausted all central pleasures that your imagination can compass. What?
I said, I mean, there weren't video games back.
Yes, but there was something
Tapestries.
My man! The tapestry! Visual pleasures! The pleasing sights. Well, a tapestry is the closest to virtual reality they have. It's a narrative world that you can enter. And what tends to be in tapestries? What are the most famous tapestries you've ever heard of? Who's ever heard of a tapestry?
What is a tapestry?
What?
That might sound really pathetic.
No, I appreciate it. It sounds really, really honest. A tapestry is a wall hanging. A rug on a wall, woven generally with a narrative scene, sometimes of battles, but what are the most famous tapestries in the world today? Almost never religious tapestries. He made a great point. Almost never religious tapestries. Tapestries are very occasions in the medieval and Renaissance world for depicting non-religious pictures. Battles, kings, magic, myth, and especially the one that was briefly
up
there, that one, the unicorn tapestry. Did you say that?
I did.
But not very loudly.
No, I shushed him up.
Oh, well, thank you for not allowing him to give the correct answer.
I'm happy to help.
Yeah, the unicorn tapestry. So that's everything. It's magic, it's paganism, it's feasting. And the tapestries were their virtual reality. They were how you could get into imaginative worlds that you couldn't experience in your daily life, even if you were a king or a prince or a maiden or a princess. Yes?
I was going to bring in Roman culture
myth,
too.
Absolutely.
The Trajan column especially. That's in Trajan's form. It's a giant column that depicts in spiral all the way down the column like the history of Trajan's rule as emperor, and it's an amazing
great example.
Visual pleasures.
Aren't they like weaving a tapestry during the myth of Athena and Arachne?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Very nice. Well said. So we have some pleasures here. We haven't gotten pleasure of
beautiful music.
Yes. So that it's the Castle Joyous is again, a kind of virtual reality castle. You've gone down into your dungeon here, your castle, and experienced all this. What's the tapestry sequence of? This is no doubt what you found to be the boring description, but it's quite important. What is it? Venus and Adonis. What's the story of Venus and Adonis?
Venus falls in love with Adonis.
Venus falls in love with... I'm going to... Prof, I'm going to take control here for a minute. Venus falls in love with Adonis. Mm-hmm. Yes,
and? She doesn't want him to hunt because it's a deadly sport. And Venus... Oh. And then one day he gets gored by a boar and he's dying and she turns him into a flower.
Correct.
Yeah, and... That's it. There's also other flower stories.
That was like... Two
pages
Yeah,
no. Is it a black handle?
No, it's not a black handle. Okay. It's the one I've been using, I think.
Okay. Should be good.
Well, let me go with the black handle and see. That's a surprise to me. Well, let me try function. Well, due to unexpected technical difficulties.
I have something that would fit with
it. Yes.
My grammar school mascot was the unicorns.
Excellent.
There was a little what are the unicorns?
Did you have a tapestry there?
No.
What are the unicorns?
They're a mythical creature.
A mythical creature?
This was the only
symbol of... What?
If you drink their blood, you'll live longer.
Oh, well, that's an interesting myth. Listen to him. He's given the answer. Your high school didn't emphasize this, did it?
Purity and innocence.
Purity and innocence. The unicorn is the magical symbol of virginity. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting symbol because it's a white beast with a phallus on his head. Yes. Chris, what?
Oh, well, I think it's in Oblivion your task to kill the last unicorn.
Oh. Kill purity.
It was great. You could write it.
Let's give control back to you, and will you go to any... just put Venus and Adonis into Google Images and pull up the first one, and we're going to watch Venus and Adonis pictures. But so here you've got the most famous tapestries of all, the Beirut tapestries of the unicorn, symbol of virginity. Spencer does not, in a book on chastity, give you an image of virginity. He gives you an image of Venus and Adonis. What's he thinking?
Where do you want, Professor, where are you looking for?
Google Images, just put Venus and Adonis into a search engine and pull us up a bunch of pictures. Okay, let's go to that first image, there, that one right there. Yeah. So who's this by? Let's see if we can identify it. Okay, that's a really boring image. Go back. Yes, sir.
I kind of thought that was the whole point of this castle, was that it's so gluttonous and Lady to Castle is completely unchaste.
Malacast is completely unchaste. And it is...
I thought that was the irony.
Thank you, Tim. You're understanding it better than you're giving yourself credit for. So you see that just Adonis like is a... This Adonis, characterize this for you. You've got three figures in here. You've got background. You've got who's that in the background? Indeed, tell me. Answer that immediately. Answer that immediately. Who is that in the background? Upper left.
Cupid.
Who is Cupid? What's his relationship to Venus?
Sun.
You've got Adonis there. Venus grabbing hold of him. Analyze that. Do an interpretation of that picture. What's interesting about it, unusual about it? This is Titian's famous painting, Venus and Adonis, which he executed in 1560, well before Spencer wrote. So this was other Renaissance thinkers, of course, in this case, an Italian Renaissance figure, were thinking about it. What do you have to say about it as an image?
He's obviously leaving. She doesn't want him to go.
Right.
She's hugging him. He's got his arms elsewhere.
And he's busy. He wants to go do what?
Redding the dogs.
He wants to be a hunter. He doesn't want any of this soft love. What else?
Spear.
And you know what kind of spear it is? What?
Well, there's like an arrow in the picture I have. There's a. If you look at it, there's. Quills.
There's the same spear.
Is that possibly the one?
It was the one that.
I can't say it.
Well, Cupid.
Is it the same one?
I would have thought it was the boar spear.
Like the boar spear.
Boar spear. Yeah. So, symbolizing his future death. He's gored in the thigh by a boar. Which is a wound in the... What kind of symbolic reading would you do of that?
In the thigh?
Yeah. Upper thigh, inner upper thigh.
yeah.
With castration.
Well, I know.
It's all
castration. What?
Too bad for Venus.
And a kind of a sexual vulnerability that he has experienced because he has given in. It's also a kind of not oddity, but it's certainly an interesting thing that it is the female pursuing the male. The male is the object of beauty in this picture. The male is the object of desire. The female is the desiring force. Why do we have this story in a book devoted to Britomart's image of chastity? Give us another image.
She's also pursuing a man.
Thank you. She's pining after Artigal. That's very well said. So what kind of chastity is it where your symbolic representation of chastity is chasing a man?
But she's chasing to, yeah, she's chasing one man.
One
she
man.
She is not, you know, she is true to that one man.
And what is, and as you well recall, on the very last page of your reading assignment for today, book 3, canto 6, stanza 52, she is going to be the ensample, middle of the stanza, to be the ensample of true love alone and lodestar of all chaste affection. That is what Britomart is. Her kind of chastity is the chastity of chaste affection, of love that will mature into marriage and sex in its proper time. There's another one, thank you. That one is by, let's see, I have the technology to identify that one. Peter Paul Rubens, 1635, after Spencer, a more fleshly female body, Cupid clinging him right around the thigh where he'll be gored shortly. Him red. Again with his boar spear. What?
Red symbolism.
Red symbolism. Very significant. Who else is wounded in Canto 1 and bleeds a little bit, but it's only... What?
Guillaume. Isn't Guillaume knocked off his
horse? Oh, Guillaume is. But I'm just trying to pick up on your point here, son. Britomart is. Britomart. I wanted you to pick up on Seth's point of reading this red clothing as an image of having been wounded, possibly wounded sexually, certainly vulnerable because of a sexual desire to wounding, occurs to Britomart. And Spencer is using the same just speck of red against the white gown as a symbol that Britomart's kind of chastity is not the kind of chastity that's just, you know, the so straight-laced, so immune to all desire.
It's not asexual.
It's not asexual. So that, you know, here on stanza, canto 1, stanza 65, if you can get to it quickly, but one of those six knights, Gardante height, meaning named, drew out a deadly bow and arrow keen, which is a kind of Cupid image, actually, which forth he sent with felonous despite and fell intent against the virgin sheen. You know, Spencer could have called her anything, but that at that moment he said against the sheen, the shine, of her virginity, the mortal steel stayed not till it was seen to gore like a boar has been shown goring Adonis, gore her side. But of course gore also means to redden with gore. It would be used in both those senses then. Yet was the wound not deep, but lightly raised her soft silken skin, that drops of purple blood thereout did weep, which did her lily, another clear image of virginity, who is always shown with a lily in paintings. Virgin Mary, thank you, very nice. In almost every Annunciation scene ever painted, the Virgin Mary will be shown with a lily either in her hand or near her. So lily is a virgin image. Her lily smock with stains of vermeil steep. So, as I said, he could have called her any kind of maiden, but in that stanza, in order to underline the same kind of symbolic resonance you saw in that red cloak, Oh, we're running short of time. We're going to stop me.
I looked at Chris and said, he's on a roll. That's, you're doing great.
God.
Chris is our timekeeper, remember.
So. He is. Well,
blood is also
so blood is also reference. So what I want you to appreciate here is that the Venus and Adonis tapestry that's up there in the Castle Joyous is a kind of counter-narrative that dominates the entire Book 3 and recurs most prominently in Canto 6. In the Garden of Adonis. The Garden of Adonis, which is this incredibly powerful mythic passage that is probably the sort of symbolic center, not just of Book 3, but of the entire Faerie Queen, we'll have to spend more time discussing next class. But if you're, you know, trying to prepare for your quiz and wanting to reread carefully, you would want to be thinking about the Garden of Adonis and the kinds of meanings that you will find all throughout that passage. Any questions? Since I would love us to plunge into the Garden of Adonis, but I don't think we can. Let's say, how is a garden? How does the space of the Garden of Adonis resemble and differ from Castle Joyous?
Open, natural.
It's open and natural, Daniel.
Well, I said it's open, obviously.
It's actually, is it? How open is it? It's walled around by two walls with two gates. Pay attention to the geography of these spaces. It's not open. It is enclosed. It is a space like that. So work on that as you finish up the remaining books of the Faerie Queen. So do we have any time left or not? Is this
Let me offer, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
Let me offer this as we move in towards more of the game design component. What I'd ask you to do is start going back to Canto 1. Who, what, when, the sequence of events is the win here, and where. Think about the settings that need to be created, the people that need to be created, potential dialogue, and order the sequence of events in a way that you think we can digest them and discuss them in class. And you know, I didn't have a chance to talk about any extra credit. We'll be working with Professor Clayton to construct some extra credit related to the game design and people who participate at a greater level in the game design, unless he has a projection of that.
Well, we will have to have a big debate over extra credit.
Yeah, because there's some pretty substantial work that can occur. There is the high level of standards we've set, and then there's some things beyond that, which I require some help on. So Professor Clayton and I will talk about opportunities there.
He's given us what kind of salute is that?
A manly one.
Respect.
Manful salute.
It is respect. It's a manful one, but what specifically is it?
Love to the heart.
Oh my God! Here in this class about classical illusions, I thought you were making a classical allusion to the Roman centurion salute. That is the Roman centurion salute. Which we'll end with on that note.
Thanks, guys.
That's the
Never Winter Nights. Hey, guys, for those of you who are interested in Have Never Winter Nights, nvbn.vanderbilt.edu, direct connect. That's going to be our server.
I love this.
Wait, if I've already...
Never Winter Nights 2, get the basic, you don't need Mask of Betrayal.
What is it?
Never Winter Nights 2, you do not need Mask of Betrayer.
Well, that hurry looks like you have.
No.
You guys
got to have the Neverwinter Nights now.
It's really awkward.
And they get
No, don't do a thing in the download.
They can't begin it?
Ready next week.
They can't begin playing it?
Yeah, they can begin any time, but it's nwn.vanderbilt.edu. That's a direct connect. That's where our game space is going to reside.
We need, wow, so I mean, I already started.
That's good.
Should we play on our server?
It's going to be local characters.
Do I have to order it, or can I just download it?
You can download it direct. Direct to drive has got has it.
You can download Tuesday.
Yeah,
you don't have to.
Right.
You didn't pay for it, but
well, yeah.
Where?
Direct number two drive.com.
So I don't have to actually order a physical.
Right. And it's actually on sale now. It's like $20
Direct to.
How many minutes do you go?